welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show. The holiday weekend coming up. Tonight we have Dr. Colin Ross, who's been on here before, author extraordinaire, psychiatrist, medical doctor. He practices in three hospitals around the country, including one over here in Torrance. Recently I've gotten to know his son, Simeon, who seems to be an up-and-coming musical genius. And Colin Ross has written the book. I'm going to hold it up now. It's called CIA Doctors, Human Rights Violations by American Psychiatrists. That's one that I highly recommend. And another one that I've just started on is called Moon Shadows, which is a book about recoveries from some horrible situations. So he is something that's very necessary today in our society to help people out with depression, because I don't know anybody that's not depressed occasionally. I know I'm very depressed right now. I was putting up a 32-inch high-definition television set tonight down in our sauna area, and I dropped it and broke it all the heck. So it's a brand new one, so I'm a little depressed, but I guess Mercury's going retrograde, so I'm $700 later. I'm going to have to get another one of these puppies, so I guess we all go through depression. So, Dr. Ross, how are you doing tonight?
Hi, I'm good, thanks. Sorry to hear about your TV.
Yeah. I went down to Costco and bought it. It was like $600. You know, they're cheaper there.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, and I'm working out on the bench, putting the mount on it so I can go up on the wall, and it fell off. I'm going to try to get the screen fixed, but I'll have to go get another one. You know what I mean? Boy, I'm just cooling off. I mean, I've been waiting 3 weeks to get this TV up down. We have an area where we have a spa and in a jacuzzi, you know, and we've been wanting television sets. So we finally had the time to go down and pick one up, and it took me forever to get the mounts made. I had to make special machine mounts for it, and then I had to call DirecTV and get one of my receivers turned on. I'm all set up to go, and bang! First time I ever, in all my years of fixing television sets, and this has been since I was a kid, it's the first time I ever actually destroyed one. It's brand new, out of the box.
Well, that's a new achievement in lifetime.
Yeah, it is. Thank you. Now, see, I like your approach. Your approach is brilliant. You know, you look on the very bright side of it.
As long as you're
I've achieved destroying a nice television. So what's your week been like?
Busy, actually. It's been really good. As you know, my son's looking at taking a jump in his music career that he's been working on for a long time. So that makes me happy just by itself.
Yeah. Peter Rafelson is a friend of BBS Radio listeners. He's talked to Don Newsom before. Because he is a media giant, he's also interested in our network, and he's going to be working with us. He just got back from the Cannes Film Festival, and he's gotten me into Skyping a lot. You know, we have this thing on where we can do a video, talk back and forth on video, which we usually do once or twice a week, which I never did before. So, and then another friend of mine got us up and running on this new television thing that we're running right now, which is really great, and people seem to really like it. We got to get you hooked up. You know?
Yeah, that'd be good. I've done, just webcam MSN chat, but not more than that.
Yeah, this is a little bit more than that, but it's using a web camera, but it actually goes out on the network. So anyhow, what's been, before we get too far, I want to talk a little bit you've given me permission to plagiarize your book, which is nice.
Any place.
Because the 149... sub projects of MK Ultra are just, I mean, unbelievable, and you've got every one of them listed, and you've also got the documents declassified in the back of the book, and you've got them all listed. Would you mind if I asked you a few questions about a few of them?
Sure, go ahead.
You probably got into them a little bit more than I had. Would that be a problem?
No.
Okay. Subcontract number 3 with George White, construction of a safe house for prostitution in 1953 for $8,875. Why would they do something like that?
Well, that's a mystery, but I got a theory. So there's several other sub-projects, which is all the work of George White, who was with the Bureau of Narcotics.
Right. That's who he's with, right?
And a pretty well-connected guy. So they set up, mostly in San Francisco, they did a little bit in New York. They set up these safe houses And when you look at the MKUltra documents, basically what you have is a whole bunch of canceled checks and receipts where the name of the supplier is whited out, but it's all kinds of curtains, bedspreads, and they basically rented these rooms and decked them out like sort of Toulouse-Lautrec brothels. And then they had prostitutes that they hired off of the street, and they had the prostitutes go to bars, pick guys up, bring them back to the safe house where the CIA guys would watch them having sex through a one-way mirror, and then the prostitutes would slip the guys a dose of LSD.
Wow.
And then
I noticed there's LSD right in there with that.
Yeah, yeah, the prostitutes would just slip it into a drink in the course of turning the trick. And in the documents it says the rationale is that they're trying to test the effects of LSD under conditions that mimic a field interrogation. So they're using unwitting citizens to check out what happens to people when they don't know they're going to get LSD.
Yeah, the same thing that people go to jail for today with the date rape drug.
Yeah, yeah, that's basically a form of date rape, yeah. And then I think another purpose of it would be if any John decides to walk into the police station, first of all, you can't do that. Say I picked up a hooker and had a trick with her and I'm upset because she gave me drugs. But even if somebody tried to talk about it, they'd be so mixed up and so discredited.
Yeah.
But then the question is, okay, that's kind of plausible, but what's the actual real purpose of the project?
Right.
So I've got everything I just said is completely documented.
Oh, I know. The documents are in this book. I highly recommend that you guys out there get this Human Violations by American Psychiatrists entitled The CIA Doctors, Colin A. Ross Medical Doctrine. You can get it off our website or his, either one. I've read this thing about three times. I was just amazed.
I started looking into it, not really that much into the whole subject. I hadn't really heard much about it, except patients started telling me about it late 91, early 92. I wasn't really knowledgeable about it or interested in it. And I thought, well, I'll look into this. I might find a little something, probably not. What I find will probably be vague. And the more I looked into it, the bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger the mountain of documents got. So as to what the real purpose of the project might be, I'm thinking that the cover story was the documents that were released. And the real story is they were, now this is a possibility, not a fact, they were maybe testing the women because the women were mentoring candidate prostitutes. So it was actually a field test of the ability of the women to pick somebody up, turn a trick, give them some LSD, carry out the assignment. And so really the guys were just kind of pawns in the game, or like little players in the drama.
Are you familiar with the Kathy O'Brien story that's out
uh-huh.
there?
Yeah, I've met her once.
Well, you met her. What, from a professional standpoint, which I highly respect your opinion, what do you think about her and her stories?
Well, first of all, I never did like an official psychiatric evaluation of her, but her and Mark Phillips, met both of them. They're not like psychotic, insane, raving, psychiatrically disturbed, you know, brains fried with drugs type people or anything like that. They're rational, they're friendly, they're well organized, you know, they got lots of information. So you can't just blow them off as some sort of psychiatric cases, that's for sure. And whether the story is accurate, not accurate, kind of distorted, mostly distorted, I don't know. The only way to know for sure is to have documents.
Yeah.
Some of the things that they tell are, you know, stretch the credulity a bunch, and others are no different from the kind of things that are in all these documents.
Now, when you're out there with your patients, and I know you've had quite a spectrum of them for a lot of years, have you run across other people with Kathy O'Brien type stories or stories that might have been, you know, fitting into these possible CIA things from a long time ago?
Yeah, I have a bunch of times. So there's nothing about the story she's telling that's unique to her. I mean, the specific details are unique to her, but the general outline of the story and the kind of things she's saying happened to her, I've met dozens of people who tell more or less similar types of stories. So this is not just one isolated person telling these stories.
Now, what kinds are these? Are these coming from a lot of different backgrounds, or similar backgrounds, or similar family backgrounds? Is there any similarity in these different people, or are they all unique?
There's no one set pattern that everybody follows, but there's a couple that recur. One is the military family, or contractors onto a military base. The dad's got some sort of connection with the military and the intelligence community. Hold on a sec.
Go ahead.
Can you close the door? The cleaning crew is just here. Sorry.
Oh, I know. I got my birds are being good because it's cloudy and raining out here, and the next door neighbor's dog bark.
Well, so
that's part of BBS. Go ahead.
Often, so there's a military connection with a civilian dad, or not uncommonly, the dad was himself in the military or in the intelligence community, and so the story then becomes that the dad basically pimped the daughter out to friends in the intelligence community, presumably for money or for power or some sort of payback of some kind. And then the kid was taken onto a base or into a hospital setting, sometimes under the guise of some kind of special educational program, sometimes sort of a babysitting-sounding scenario after school, and there'd be a whole variety of things done, which are all obviously mind control training and programming.
It's interesting. Now, how recent, I mean, is this still going on, or is this phased out? I know, but for example, the Tuskegee study on syphilis on black African American males ended in 72 when it got public exposure, and this seems
right
to be getting that now. Is this still going on, or do you think it's ending now, or do you think it's just more covert than it was?
I think it's been shift. Personally, now I can't prove this.
Yeah.
Personally, I think it's still operational. All the major intelligence agencies around the world, all the major terrorist organizations, and in the United States, been bumped from academia into private sector contracting mostly.
Yeah. Because I know in your book, you really show in these early projects that there was almost an ambition with the psychiatrists and medical doctors to jump on these projects.
No, not almost. There's one set of documents. There's a whole chapter in the book on this guy, G.H. Estabrooks.
Right. I read that, yeah.
And he was very aggressively marketing himself as a contractor who could create mentoring candidates and who had created them for operational use for the Department of the Army in the Second World War. And he's not just making that up. He's got, in the documents, there's a lot of connections with a lot of other senior people in the hypnosis world. He was at a college in Upper State, New York. He had all kinds of military people out for seminars. He was teaching at seminars at various military bases. And there's correspondence from the 1930s through to the early 1970s between him and J. Edgar Hoover. And there's declassified CIA documents where he's very aggressively trying to sell his mentoring candidate services to the CIA. So,
you know, one of the along those lines, one of the guys I used to listen to was Long John Nebel out of New York.
Right. Yeah, I've read the book about his wife, Candy Jones.
And Candy Jones, I guess she was some kind of a candidate. I mean, she actually performed for them, right? I mean, that was. And she was a very famous kind of, I forget her name here, you might remember it, but
she was the main, well, one of the two or three main pin-up girls, troop entertainment women in Pacific Theater in the Second World War.
Yeah.
Very well known at the time. And, yeah, she was having kind of headaches and vague medical problems, and Long John Nebel, who was a radio guy who married her, started hypnotizing her to see if he could get some symptom relief.
Oh, that's what happened.
And then out pours this whole story about being recruited, being programmed, and going on a whole bunch of courier and other missions around the world. And let's see now.
Yeah, Jessica Wilcox was her name,
yeah. 60s to early 70s.
Yeah, and she had a stage name, and she would perform with Bob Hope and some of these greatest people around, I guess, at these USO things around the world, didn't she?
Yeah, yeah. She was at the pinnacle of troupe entertainment, touring in the Pacific, all of that. And she had an alter personality named Arlene Grant, who was the one who was operational. There's a lot of documentation, and it's not completely proven that the story is real, but it's very plausible. You know, it's not some kind of chaotic, ridiculous story. It's very clearly told. It's very plausible.
Yeah, because you have it well documented. I mean, this chapter in your book is so well documented. It's so factual. I'm just blown away by it.
Well, I was too when I was looking into it more and more and more. Like I said, the amount of facts that came tumbling out was just amazing. And you'd think it would be something that would just be like science fiction and a few people are talking about in the basement sort of thing. It's thoroughly documented. And the most of the places that I got the documents, besides the Freedom of Information Act, were journals on the shelves at the medical school library.
Wow.
I mean, it wasn't like there was no deep throat involved at all. It's all public domain information.
Wow. That's amazing. And then you've got another story in here. This is a great book. I hope everybody starts buying this book. The next other chapter was the case history of Sirhan Sirhan.
Yeah, I've been involved in a couple of cable documentaries about Sirhan Sirhan as well. And,
wow.
Because obviously it's an extremely interesting, important story. And the problem is you can never quite nail down that he was handled by somebody and was a Manchurian candidate, but there's all kinds of tantalizing circumstantial evidence. He definitely has, unless he's outright lying, he has amnesia for the shooting. Looks like he may have been programmed by famous hypnotist William Jennings Bryan. And there's all kinds of details about the assassination itself that are fishy. And just the physical evidence on that assassination is extremely fishy. There was, according to the Los Angeles County Coroner official report, there was, I think the numbers, I can't remember if the numbers 9 or 10, but 9 or 10 entry holes in people and the surrounding doors and walls, which is more than the number of chambers in Sirhan Sirhan's gun. So the official report of the medical examiner, Los Angeles County, was that there had to be another shooter.
And now, he was shot, what, in a pantry or something?
Yeah.
Now, my friend Paul Schrade was also shot with him. I actually worked for Paul Schrade for short time when I was working with the United Auto Workers Union. And he got a bullet or two himself.
Hmm. What was his impression of the number of shots and how it all happened?
I never talked to him after that, but I think he got about shot once or twice. He wasn't fatally shot.
Right.
But there's two bullets right there that we know of that went into somebody else. It was with Bobby Kennedy.
And the shot was apparently a rear entry shot from a couple inches behind his head. And Sirhan Sirhan was clearly several feet out to the front all the way through the shooting. So there's a lot of things about that. It's just not possible that he's the only shooter.
Yeah, it's almost like the John Kennedy shooting where it looks like the limo driver turns around and shoots him point blank.
Yeah.
Some of the film footage I saw. Did you ever see that footage?
No, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah,
actually,
there was
just,
some real interesting
funnily
footage
enough,
there.
Just before I drove down to the office to talk to you, I was watching a JFK assassination Japanese TV program that I was interviewed on. It's kind of hard to watch because it was all in Japanese, but you could kind of follow it. And they were doing sound analysis, and they were coming up with 4 bullet shots.
And how many? I don't even know the type of weapon that he used, but probably, was it a pistol, do you know, or an automatic, or what?
A scoped automatic pistol.
Wow. Wow. Oh,
not Oswald, the shooter on the grassy knoll.
Yeah, on the grassy knoll, yeah.
Oswald was the
famous... And then you have a... And You have a chapter now. I know you wrote a screenplay. You have a chapter here on Mark David Chapman.
Yeah, that's another very interesting story. And
now, before you go into that, I remember that FBI was all over John Lennon. They tried to throw him out of this country. They couldn't do that. They hated him.
Yeah, there's a very good documentary that was came out about a year and a half ago,
United
States versus John Lennon. Very well done. Goes into all that in detail.
What was your opinion of this?
Well, as far as motive, I mean, those guys were clearly really pissed at him and wanted him out of the country, those guys being J. Edgar Hoover, etc.
Right.
And they lost in court. And they saw him as this kind of agitator of youth against the Vietnam War, going to stir up trouble on campus and so on. So there's no problem with the motive and obviously the means.
Yeah.
And I've seen Ringo Starr mention, you know, in a couple of interviews that they were having a lot of trouble with the FBI in that time period. And the FBI was, you know, harassing John Lennon. So Ringo Starr seems well aware of that.
Yeah. No, I was well aware of it, too. I remember what Richard Nixon said is that the biggest problem with the Vietnam War was the opposition to it, the American opposition to it.
The whole story of the Vietnam War is another amazing story that's a sub-story in the history of CIA military mind control just by itself, how it got set up.
Well, I know that supposedly France, I know France had had control of that for a long time, and my personal opinion of that war was, at the beginning anyway, was that France shouldn't have been in there. They were not treating the Vietnamese very nice.
Right.
And I also heard that Ho Chi Minh was not a communist.
Well, I write about that in the introduction to the book just to show how twisted and convoluted the whole history can be.
Yeah.
So, a quick summary. As everybody knows, none of this is just controversial, just the facts. So we've
right.
got the Second World War going on. We've got the good guys and the bad guys. So the good guys are us, equals Canadians, Americans, British, Australian, and so on. And the Russians are kind of basically on our side because they're fighting against the Germans. And then the bad guys are Germany, Italy, etc. And so all those battle lines are clear. To help prepare for the invasion of Sicily, there was a deal done between U.S. government and the mafia to let Lucky Luciano out of jail early
right.
to help prepare with the invasion of Sicily. This is during a time period when J. Edgar Hoover's official position is that there's no organized crime in the United States. And at the same time, the government is doing deals with organized crime.
Yeah.
So towards the end of the war, Alan Dulles was running an operation over in Europe, and his main goal was to try and recruit the Nazi spy network and intelligence network, which he did successfully, to work on behalf of the United States in the Cold War against the Russians. But before the end of the war, the Russians were our friends and the Japanese were our enemies. And the Nazis were our enemies.
Right.
So we were fighting to support the French resistance against the Nazi occupation, which is straightforward, everybody understands that. Except there's a complication because the British were at war with the Nazi sympathizer government and actually engaged the Nazi sympathizer French government in naval combat in 1940. So there's a history of our allies, the British, fighting against our allies, the French.
Right, which
so
goes back to the where we got the freedom because the French helped the American in the Revolutionary War.
Right, so there's all these convoluted relationships. And then over on the other side of the world, it's clearly the case that the Japanese are our enemies, and we're forming an alliance with Chiang Kai-shek, and his Air Force was called the Flying Tigers.
Right.
Which was all American pilots, American planes. So we're running basically support for him in the his war against the Japanese, which is also our war, so all the battle lines are very clear and who the friends are and who's the enemy. But Chiang Kai-shek was basically an enemy of Mao Zedong, who occupied northern China at the time. And we simultaneously supplied logistical support and arms to Mao Zedong. So that was a little complication. But there was a man who helped the OSS in their efforts to combat the Japanese in North Vietnam and Southern Korea. And one of his duties was to locate down flying Tiger pilots and bring them out to safety. So this guy, whose Vietnamese name I can't quite remember, was captured and imprisoned by one of Chiang Kai-shek's intelligence people. But he was actually helping us, so that was a problem, because our friend Chiang Kai-shek was imprisoning our friend, this Vietnamese guy, who was supporting recovery of flying Tiger pilots. So what happened was there was a deal made by a Japanese warlord to spring this guy out of jail. And he got out of jail, went back to North Vietnam, and changed his name to Ho Chi Minh.
Oh, that's where he came from.
Yeah. And the reason he did that was to avoid further capture by our ally Chiang Kai-shek.
Okay.
So the OSS supported him, and he was an ally of ours. He was like the French Resistance, basically, but in Vietnam. And OSS Deer Team medics saved his life with medications when he had dysentery, malaria, something like that. And there's a photograph in this book I read about it, which is a very scholarly book, not a, you know, sort of off the deep end type book at all. There's a photograph of Ho Chi Minh's right-hand man, Colonel Giap, I think was his name.
Hmm?
He's standing beside a guy named Archimedes Paddy, who is a colonel in the OSS, and he's saluting the U.S. flag as a band is going down the street playing the Star Spangled Banner in Hanoi.
Wow.
And then subsequent to the liberation of Hanoi from our enemies, the Japanese, there's a telex that Ho Chi Minh sent saying he wants to establish a free country with the support of the League of Nations and a democracy in North Vietnam and unify North Vietnam, South Vietnam. And the OSS, which had been disbanded at the end of the war, but the personnel, including the guy who founded it, Wild Bill Donovan, made lots of trips into North and South Vietnam with support from Chase Manhattan Bank, etc., to try and build infrastructure and build up North and South Vietnam. But then what happened was this didn't go over very well when the heads of state of Russia, United States, England were meeting subsequent to the World War and sort of carving the world up into pieces. So along with setting up the Berlin Wall and all that, there was a decision made under diplomatic pressure to give South Vietnam back to the French. So South Vietnam was liberated, working on being united and forming a democracy with support from U.S. business, but that wasn't allowed to happen because the deal made at the state-type level. And so what happened was Vietnam was cut in half, Ho Chi Minh was given the northern half, and then gradually defined as a communist enemy. All the support for him was pulled, basically. So he turned to Mao, who in the meantime had taken over China for support, and was redefined as a communist trying to take over South Vietnam. And then John Foster Dulles, the brother of Alan Dulles, who was head of the CIA during MKUltra.
He was the director of CIA, yeah, Alan was.
So his brother, John Foster Dulles, created the domino theory, and we had to draw a line in the sand somewhere, otherwise the communists were just going to continue to encroach. And that was really the rationale for going into Vietnam to start with, was the domino theory. So it was just like the current Gulf War. There actually obviously wasn't any.
Yeah, I agree totally. It's like the scenario of the beginning of Afghanistan war right down to where it is now. It's the same story.
Yeah, because there's obviously no imminent threat. It's not like South Vietnam was going to invade the United States.
No,
so
I don't think
so. It's all justified by the domino theory, and it was really just a geopolitical chess game.
Yeah.
There was really no need. The Vietnam War, in my opinion, was completely preventable and unnecessary, and could have, if the French were just told to forget it, they're not getting South Vietnam back, and we hadn't got into all the diplomatic mess that followed from that, there never would have been a Vietnam War.
Yeah, I mean, even today, you know, Vietnam is a tourist place. It's like Hawaii.
Right.
It's not producing oil or, you know, vast resources of gold like Africa or diamonds.
Right.
It's just a tourist place. Maybe,
well, so that's why we needed a
rational. There, but I don't even think they do much of that, you know.
Well, we needed a theory to support going in there, and that was the domino theory.
Yeah, look at all the American lives that died there, and look at all the American lives that died now. We probably had as much injured in this last war that we're in now, which is ridiculous, as they had in Vietnam. We're probably getting the numbers, probably getting there. I knew a lady in Hawaii I met. Her name was Pam Black, and she was Vietnamese, and her dad was a general Black.
Mm-hmm.
I guess he was one of the right-hand men of Ho Chi Minh. And she told me a similar story. It was really interesting.
Well, this is not just, you know, something that somebody dreamed up somewhere. This is in a very scholarly, academic, reference book. With
yeah, no, I understand that. Yeah, you're
That's
right.
That's an amazing thing.
I know that.
But it's not, and nevertheless, it's not general knowledge.
No. Unfortunately, this stuff, unless we get you on here and you and I can sort this out, people never really will understand what really happened then, and it's a pattern.
Oh, it's absolutely a pattern, yeah.
Yeah, and I studied the Dulles brothers because they lived in a time when Project Corona was happening. We were trying to get the spy satellites up.
Right.
And from my side of it, I was very aware of Kelly Johnson, who founded Area 51, who was a friend of the Dulles brothers. Edwin Land, who's Land Camera, and iTech, which was the maker of the cameras, was one of my clients back when I'm an electronics company. So I actually, as a young guy, experienced some of these individuals, you know. And so it's neat to bring this out on the air now because these shows get archived,
right?
And then I make a big headliner out of them, and then this tonight's show will be heard many thousands of times over the next year or two. So it's important to get this stuff out because nobody ever seems to be able to get it clear. And then the other thing that I run into, and this is what I really like about you, is people start saying the government did it, this happened, blah, 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 but they don't have the facts. You know,
right.
You have a complete lineage of facts that can be, you know, you can get testimonials, you can discover it, you can go on the internet, you can go anywhere you want. And I always tell my audiences, prove me wrong when I start spouting facts. Show me where I'm wrong, and I'll change it. So far, nobody has, you know.
Well, I was talking about this, all the CIA mind control history, a bit at some conferences and so on.
Yeah.
And some people caught wind of it in the field of psychiatry. And I got, for a number of years, I got ridiculed, made fun of, you know, accused of being a CIA conspiracy nut, all that kind of stuff in, like, Esquire magazine, cable TV shows. The British Journal of Psychiatry, the Journal of the American Medical Association, like supposed, you know, reputable places. And then when the book came out in 2000 under the title Bluebird, I republished it under a different title because it didn't really tell you what the book was about to call it Bluebird.
What was it? What title was that?
Now it's the CIA Doctors.
Yeah, the one I got here.
Right. But when the book came out, all of a sudden, all that ridiculing completely
went away, didn't it?
Total silence, because there's nothing you can ridicule in it. It's all facts.
Yeah. I had the same problem. When I used to tell people that when I left NASA, I went to 3,000 companies as a consultant for the next 6 years. Nobody can do that. Well, I got so fed up with it that on the Internet, it's on BBS Radio in my biography, I put up my discharge, you know, where I left the Air Force when I left working for the Skunk Works, Lockheed. I worked there.
Right.
Where I had to sign off on my secret clearance under, you know, under penalty of, you know, losing my life practically. All the documents I put up there, and then I put up a few pages of my journals, maybe 40 or 50 of the 3,000 companies with names, addresses, times, blah blah blah. It's all up there. Guess what? It got real quiet.
Right.
Nobody hassles me anymore.
Right.
That's the way God bless the internet, huh?
Well, the internet's an amazingly powerful
tool.
Good evening, gentlemen.
It's fun to really go into this. So I'm turning back to one thing I want to say before I turn back to this where we started here. Oh, we have a caller, I think. Is there a caller on the line?
Yes, it is, dear.
Who are you calling?
This is Jehala in the Smoky Mountains.
Oh, how are you doing?
All right. Love your death. Love his courage.
Dr. Ross is one of the most amazing psychiatrists, medical doctors on the planet, and he's brilliant.
So, if I say some things tonight, I guess we can carry on further with this conversation, get into it deeper, right?
Yeah, that's
okay.
If you have a question for Dr. Ross, go ahead.
Well, what I'd like for him to elaborate on, if he could, is we talk about the CIA and all the things that they did in the government and everything. But the truth of the matter is, and I would like confirmation on this, because I just kind of stumbled onto this today, got banned from a forum, GLP, we'll say, for even typing out the word Tavistock Institute. And I got banned. It seems that they don't even want the word Tavistock typed in their forum, so I will respect that.
Which forum is this now?
It's just one of the conspiracy
chat forum?
Cake forums.
Well, the Tavistock Clinic is a
it's not
a publicly
nonprofit.
Existing thing. It's not cloaked in secrecy at all. It's a psychiatric hospital in London, England. It has a long history of all kinds of academic work and publishing and known around the world, etc., and also pretty
Sigmund
intertwined.
Sigmund Freud founded it.
Pardon me?
Sigmund Freud founded it.
I don't think that's correct, but basically the Tavistock Clinic, I think, is
no,
likely
this,
heavily
this
intertwined.
No, this has to do with the Committee of 300.
Yeah, it's heavily intertwined with the history of mind control. That's
mm-hmm.
the basic thing. Mm-hmm.
Where is it at, Colin?
In London.
In London, okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
but it's not a secret
organization.
It's a publicly existing.
Well, it seems they're involved in a lot of the, just like what you were talking about a little bit ago in your conversation with Dr. Bell, was they were involved in the LSD trips, and they've had to pay a lot of money to some of the families of these CIA agents that they were given a lot of this acid to.
Actually, the amount of money they paid was just, by CIA budgetary standards, just chicken feed, or just pennies.
I would just encourage everybody to Google Tavistock Institute and read about it.
Yeah, Tavistock.
Yeah, Tavistock.
Yeah, Tavistock.
Uh-huh, Tavistock.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
All right, thanks for calling in. Yeah, now, Colin, you're working on a screenplay. I don't think... You emailed me a copy of that, but I need a written copy of that, and I think Peter Rapelson needs to see that too. Tell us a little bit about that if you don't want to, then we'll just go on to something else.
I've brought it out as a book along with several other screenplays, and I just got the proof copy, so the actual first print run will be in my hands in like 2 to 3 weeks, so I can send you the whole thing in book.
Yeah, because I want to take a copy over to Peter too.
Sure.
I think he's producing 3 films as we speak.
I'd be extremely interested in having it made into a movie. That's why I wrote it.
Yeah.
And it's basically, it's fictional, and it's kind of there's a TV series, and then there's a two-hour one, which could either be a two-hour pilot or independent feature film.
Right.
And so it's fictional, and it's kind of ER crossed with The X-Files crossed with Clear and Present Danger.
Right,
it's
which
kind of
is really coming back. The X-Files just comes out. Now we got Indiana Jones back out. Perfect timing, by the way.
And so it's got government conspiracy, mind control, Manchurian candidates, and psychiatry all mixed together.
Yeah.
And terrorism is tied in there. It's one of those kind of psychological thriller convoluted things.
I can't wait to get a copy of that.
I think it's a fun movie.
Well, I think it'd be great to produce it, be an executive producer on it.
Go for it.
Yeah,
not
going to
get any complaints from me.
No.
And it's, it would be, besides being entertaining as a movie, I mean, the number one thing if you're making a movie, it needs to be entertaining. But it also would help people to understand multiple personality and would bring the Manchurian candidate programs and that whole issue out into public more, which is a healthy thing.
Yeah, while we're talking about that, could you, there's some people out there that, they realize that, from the Korean War, fictitious character came, blah, blah, blah. Explain to them, if you don't mind, a little bit about taking, what a Manchurian candidate actually is.
Okay.
So
first of all,
put it on the record here.
The Manchurian Candidate is a book by Richard Condon that then got made into a movie that came out early 60s. and Frank Sinatra was, you know, one of the main characters in it. It's a really good movie. Angela Lansbury is another main character in the movie. So just as a movie, you know, it's very entertaining, well-made, good movie to watch. And then a couple of years ago, there was a remake of it with Denzel Washington, where it was kind of updated to the present day and the Gulf War. And a few of the details were changed around, but it was the same basic idea. And so if you just watched it, you'd think, well, that's a good piece of science fiction. But what The Manchurian Candidate is, basically, is an artificially created multiple personality using hypnosis, interrogation techniques, drugs, sensory deprivation, and so on. And you create a new identity inside the person. You use hypnotic access codes so you can call this new identity out at will. And this is described by this G.H. Esterbrooks guy in published documents that are in the book. And he describes these are being used operationally in the Second World War. So basically, if it's a courier mission, the guy's called into Colonel whoever's office, and he said, oh, we're sending you to Tokyo on a courier assignment. And it's some routine, you know, non-high-level assignment. He says, okay. And then Esterbrooks, or whoever the handler is, says the code word. And he uses the example of the moon is clear. So he says the moon is clear. The guy switches to his artificially created identity. Then he gives that identity the real courier assignment, which is the classified information, flips him back, again, just using hypnotically implanted signal, flips him back to his regular identity. He has no knowledge, conscious knowledge, of the information he's carrying inside. He goes off to Tokyo. The handler at the far end says, thanks, that's nice to have this information. Good job. The moon is clear. He flips to the classified identity, gives out the classified information. Then a response is inserted. The Manchurian Candidate identity goes back inside again. Back home he goes, and same thing again at the far end. So it's basically any type of assignment, whether it be courier, infiltration, penetration, assassination. The idea basically is there's a whole red herring about, is it possible to make people do things they wouldn't ordinarily do using hypnosis? And then people get into debates about it's not possible to create a Manchurian Candidate because you really can't make people do stuff they don't want to do. Now, that's a red herring because it has nothing to do with doing things that you don't want to do. Getting people into the military and training them to go kill people is not difficult. So the whole purpose is not to make somebody go on a mission and kill somebody. You just have to send them to boot camp for that. The whole purpose is if they get caught, they're going to be more resistant to interrogation because they absolutely have no conscious identity. I mean conscious knowledge of their mission. So to me, it's all about resisting interrogation. And then in order to resist interrogation, there's levels and levels and layers of all kinds of, you know, locks and codes and keys and access barriers and so on. That's the basic idea of The Manchurian Candidate.
Yeah, I think in some of your writings you talk about some of the procedures that people do to separate them from their normal selves. And some
right.
of it, some
and
of that
it's
stuff,
all...
they use a lot of drugs. I mean, these subcontracts that are in, we didn't, the show will be over here in a little bit, we didn't get, 5% into the subcontracts, but a lot of those were about conditioning people for that kind of operation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, some of the lead contractors are describing in the contract documents absolutely clearly, upfront, not vague, this is what we're doing. We're using hypnosis to create multiple personalities. I mean, it's not something you have to kind of guess by reading between the lines. It's very clear, very explicit, very detailed. And then the reason that The Manchurian Candidate is called The Manchurian Candidate is because that's the title of the book. But why is that the title of the book? Well, in these declassified documents from early to mid-50s, there's an internal CIA memo where the CIA officer is saying he's concerned and he's going to investigate further that there's a story being told that there's a group of American GIs who were captured while crossing through a zone in Manchuria, and some sort of conditioning techniques have been used on them, and they have amnesia for a period of time, in Manchuria. So the actual plot of the movie is in CIA documents from before the publication of the book.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, and then, you know, today I think they're using implants. I think they're using, radio frequency transmissions into people's heads like they did on the runway of the airport to get rid of some birds a few years ago.
Right.
I think they've taken it to this is like we're talking back in the 50s. We're talking, 50 years ago.
Yeah, back in the 50s, this is declassified stuff from MKUltra now. They're doing things like beaming either infrasound or radio frequencies at monkeys' heads, and if they get the beam to be a little bit too intense, it cooks the monkey's brain. So they're just like monkeying around with basic calibration of primitive instruments. And that's, before computers and before all of miniaturization and before cell phones and all this kind of stuff. So how miniaturized and high-tech it is now, I'm sure we can't even begin to imagine.
Yeah, I'm not surprised if they don't have, like sometimes when I go out to record music, I'll put energy across a sound across a sacred Indian place or something, and then I'll record it on a digital machine, and I'll put it in the mix at 20 decibels below the sound where you can't hear it, but subconsciously it gives you a good feeling. That's some of the stuff that we do in music. I'm sure with this right now, with cell phones, that there's a lot of subconscious programming going on the carrier wave of a cell phone. I mean, I'm sure that's going on. I would be shocked if it wasn't. What do you think?
I actually don't know anything about that, but I'd say anything's possible, basically.
Well, in the subcontracts, I forget where they were, there was a guy in here that was radio control. He had a little box he put together, and he was controlling monkeys.
Yeah, that's a guy named Jose Delgado, who is a neurosurgeon at Yale.
Yeah.
The way I built up this whole history is by reading this paper from a medical journal in 1950
or 73. Yeah, it was in 59 even, it's in your book, yeah.
And then I'd read a paper, and then I'd look at the references at the end of the paper, and then I'd say, oh, well, he also published a paper with this guy. So then I'd go and look at journals from 5 years before, 5 years after, and you have to do this all by hand because none of this stuff is computer indexed because it's too old. And then I'd find, here, the co-author of this guy wrote a paper with this guy, and that guy wrote a paper with this guy who wrote a paper with this guy, and I just built up the whole network that way.
Wow, that's brilliant.
So this...
that's brilliant.
Is it?
That's absolutely brilliant. And that's
more
the
laborious
best way
than brilliant,
of getting a hold of covert research there is.
This is just at the medical school library.
Yeah.
And so,
I know, but I just think it's brilliant because you went in, you got the papers, and I know, I study several different, medical journals around the country. I've been doing that for a number of years, but I never even thought to go into a project like you did and then go find the research, the people that are doing similar projects in that time period. That's brilliant.
Thanks. Well, the main thing I think, besides being interested and not being too lazy doing the work, the main thing it took was, people sometimes say, aren't you paranoid? And my answer to that is, to publish a book like this and do this kind of research, you have to work very hard on not being paranoid.
Yeah, I can agree.
And many people, like other psychiatrists or colleagues who hear about it, they go, I don't know if I even want to talk to you, sort of response. I found out a whole lot about Jose Delgado, and he's very connected into people at Harvard and many other leading people in the history of psychiatry. And there's actually archival video footage that it's been maybe on 3 or 4 cable documentaries I've been involved in. The producers have gotten this archival footage, which is not that hard to get. And it shows him in a... I guess it's in Spain. But anyway, he's in a bull ring, and there's a bull that comes running at him, and he pushes the button on the box, and the bull just turns around and walks away. And what he's doing, he also did with human beings. So he describes in his publications, mainstream medical journals, implanting brain electrodes in kids as young as 5 years old, 6 years old, and a lot of teenagers, absolutely just for experimental purposes, not for treatment at all. He pops an electrode in there, and then he shows photographs in his publications of he's pressing this button on the box, and this girl's like pounding the wall and then having a fit. He pushes another button, and she's sitting there staring off into space. He pushes another button, and she's strumming on her guitar. And then he's got a whole set of animal experiments where he puts electrodes in, and he's able to stimulate the electrodes remotely using his radio transmitter. And he refers to these animals in his publications as mechanical toys.
And then I've done a little research on him. I saw this guy must have been a prodigy of Joseph Mengele or somebody, you know.
Something like that. And he wrote a book where his basic thesis is, you know, we've been evolving along and we've been making progress as a race, but we need to take the next jump in evolution. We need to start controlling our own brains. And so one thing you could do would be, for instance, get rid of all the rioting and watts by just taking all these guys who are not quite genetically right and happen to be black and happen to live in the ghetto, popping a brain electrode into their heads, and using the transmitter box to control their behavior. And the title of the book is Towards a Psycho-Civilized Society. And, of course, you don't need to point out that Delgado's not going to have electrodes in his brain.
No, of course not.
So him and his friends will be this government elite literally controlling the entire population with brain electrode implants.
And they're really pushing implants now. I think, personally, that the technology has gone beyond that, and I think that now they probably have identified the neural circuits and the resonant frequencies of those neural circuits, and they can probably put an implant anywhere in the body and then just modulate that those neural circuits through the body itself.
Or just do it directly with wireless.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the next big step, and that's what I've been doing a lot of research on, Project Moonbeam with NASA and some of this other stuff that's going on now is looking a lot like, I remember when the Clementine satellites were going up and the HART project started mm-hmm. off. That HART project is quite capable of controlling many, many thousands and maybe even millions of human minds. And if they use what I call the neurophonic technology, where they use two different radio frequency beams and they separate the radio frequency by an audio tone or a modulated audio frequency, it gives the person the power. I think some people, I don't think you or I would be susceptible too much to that because we got we're strong, but most people aren't.
Right.
You know, I would be a very hard subject to hypnotize, yet I used to hypnotize my entire 11th grade class and at once, the whole class.
Hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And make them do funny things. But so people like us, you know, we're pretty driven. But the average person often isn't, you know, and it's not saying that we're beyond the average person because we are average people, but we're highly disciplined and our educational background shows that we're driven somehow.
Well, there's clear data. Well, number one, there's clear data that every man has his breaking point in an interrogation situation.
Yeah.
But there's clear data, published, public domain data, that you can, in fact, train special forces and so on to resist interrogation better than the average person. And there's clear data to that effect. So.
Yeah, we got a caller, but we only got a minute, caller.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we only got a couple minutes.
Yeah, okay. This is George in Austin, Texas.
Yeah, hi.
And how you doing?
Good.
Was the 9/11 attack trauma-based programming that resulted in a greater dissociative type of mode in a lot of people in the country? Doctor?
Sorry, I didn't quite catch all of that. You're asking whether there's mind control programming that deliberately creates more dissociation in people?
I'm saying, did the 9/11 event, did it create a greater dissociative mode in many people in the country?
Well, that's an interesting question. I haven't exactly thought about. It created more post-traumatic stress, that's for sure.
A lot, yeah, which then Bush pretty much rode rain on with his whole running his whole party.
I would, I'd have to think about that a bunch, but I would say, yeah, I guess it probably did.
Good so point. It induced a greater problem into the whole country as a whole, maybe?
No question, yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking my call. I appreciate it. Dr. Bell, thank you.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome. Thanks
good night.
For the great question.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah, yeah. So anyhow, Colin, give out your information, your website, and that, and because we're blowing past the time we got to be off the air. But this has been a fun program with you as always, you know.
All right. Well, we'll do it again. www.rossinst.com. So it's short for Ross Institute, or you can just Google under Colin A. Ross, MD. It'll come up, and. My books are on my webpage, and you also can get them off Amazon.com.
Yeah, or a Paradigm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good place, too.
Yeah. And then, well, we haven't even had time to put them up on the, you know, we're going to do a presentation on our front page. It's just more, you know, it's just more real estate, more coverage. People that don't know you, that know me, will come to you eventually. Because I think your information is really important. So anyway, we look forward to having you back on. It's the second time you've been on this show. Everybody loves it.
Looking forward to the 20th time.
Archives, come to their archives. Tell your friends out there that about the archives. Come and listen to Dr. Ross. We've got a seminar coming up in a couple of weeks out here. There's information at www.paradigm.com or type Dr. Fred Bell in the search engine. So you've been listening to Dr. Fred Bell's Health Science and Energy Show, the last show before the big holiday. We're going to have some fun next week, and we look forward to having Dr. Ross on. And I'm just going to start moseying out of here, just leaving out of here.
$5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.